Hi, everyone. Eve Harrow, Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. It is the evening of November 9th, 2020 here in Israel. The beginnings of the 23rd day of Cheshvan, 5781. Been a really crazy week, I would say, not just for me, but for many people. And I'm not going to talk about the American elections. There'll be plenty of time for that, and who knows still where it's going. I told you last week, I believe, that I had a new grandson. And so just as we read on Shabbat in the weekly portion in the parasha about Avraham Avinu having a brit, having joining the covenant with God that's specific to males. Women are born already perfect, so we're good to go on that. So my grandson, as well, on Sunday morning, was brought into the Jewish people. And it was really moving, as you can very well imagine, very small, really just his parents and his grandparents were there. And of course, the Moel, the guy who does the whole thing. It was really very, very special and wonderful to have good news in these crazy times. And he was named Nadav Shalev. Nadav, after there's a biblical character named Nadav, but the meaning of Nadav is somebody who gives. The Baron Rothschild was who was a tremendous benefactor, and that's what he was known as, Hanadiv, in the early days of the Jewish resettlement of the land of Israel at the end of the 19th century. He was incredibly helpful. If you volunteer, you're a mitnadev. That's the source of that word, is someone who gives of his time, of his efforts, of his wisdom, of his money, whatever it is. So blessing little Nadav Shalev, that he will always have enough of what he needs so that he can give to others as well. And that for many, many, many years, as they say, ad me'avesrim, until 120, the world benefits from his presence. His middle name, Shalev, they gave because of the situation that the world is in now. It means calm, peace, serenity, in the hopes that that's what will happen in Israel, in the world. And we'll have more of that, at least, or at least less of the chaos that's been going on up until now. And babies bring blessings. I do believe that. So I hope so. In any event, he's very, very cute. And we're just happy to have him part of our, thank God, growing, expanding family here in the land of Israel. I was shocked, as I'm sure many of you were, as Shabbat ended, to hear of the death of Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, somebody who really I related to and read virtually all his books, many of his books, and in the prayer services, use his prayer books on Yom Kippur and on the Haggadah on Passover, and just his wisdom and his insights and the incredible way that he had of making a point, I know changed my life. I know that I've integrated many of the things that he said and did into my world, into my guiding, into my explanations maybe of why things happen. And I know that I'm not the only one, and not just in the Jewish world. He was perhaps a once in a generation kind of a figure. A few years ago, I was in the States on a speaking trip, and I saw that he was in Philadelphia. He was the scholar in residence at Shabbat in a community where I have friends. And so I arranged to be in Philadelphia for Shabbat just to participate in that weekend and hear some of the things that he had to say. That was also, the flight to Philly was also for to hear him was also where some of you might have heard the story. I think I've told it before. I'm sure I've told it before. I just don't remember when. When I was waiting for the plane, and there's a big guy in line also waiting with me, really big guy, like tattoos, like the whole business. And we're waiting in line. This is when people were fly places and wait in line and even closer than 2 meters and not wear masks. Yeah, remember those days? Anyway, so he asked where I was going, and I said I was going to Philadelphia, and he said he was going to Bethlehem. And I think we were flying out of St. Louis or Chicago, I don't remember. Anyway, so I said, oh, that's great. I said, I live near Bethlehem. He said, really, where do you live? And I said, it's called Efrat. And he said, I never heard of Efrat. And I said, well, that's because I live near the real Bethlehem, you know, the one in Judea, We ended up having a really, really interesting conversation, as you can imagine. Although I heard not long ago that there is an Efrat in Pennsylvania. So if anybody knows that, that would be interesting. I guess I could just look it up. But anyway, so yeah, that was where I was going, was to hear Rabbi Sacks and our amazing technician here at the Land of Israel Network, Ben Bresky, found the interview that I had with Rabbi Sacks over 5 years ago. He graciously gave me an interview, and that is going to be the rest of this podcast. It's incredible how timely it still is. Certain things have changed, maybe even for the better, I would say, at least in the Middle East here, in terms of perhaps coming to more peaceful relations with our neighbors and them maybe, just maybe, laying down the sword. I think it's important to hear in his own words and in his own voice. And so I was really honored to be able to have that interview with him. And I would imagine that most of you wouldn't remember it, or maybe you weren't listening at the time. We were still on the Voice of Israel, the short-lived studios that we had, which were really incredible for doing our podcast. In any event, so Ben found the interview, and that's going to be the rest of this show. And as they say in Hebrew, Baruch Dayan HaEmet, God, I suppose, is the true judge, is how that would be loosely translated. Taken from us, though, way too soon, way too early at 72. I'm sure he had much more to share with us, but somebody decided that he needed to be in another place, and the world is going to be much poorer for it. So Eve Harrow, Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. And I hope that you enjoy Rabbi Sacks. And I know from all of us, just hoping that, you know, that he may rest in peace, and that the world also goes to something more of a peaceful place and less divisive place. So take care, everybody, and enjoy. And I will be back, God willing, next week. Hi, everybody. Eve Harrow on Rejuvenation for Voice of Israel. And very, very honored to have on the line with me now from Great Britain, Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, former Chief Rabbi of the Commonwealth, just finished up a trip here to the Holy Land. Was so busy that didn't have time to come into the studio, but graciously agreed, despite a very, very busy week, and we'll talk about why in just a minute, to be interviewed online. So, Rabbi Sacks, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, it's good to speak to you, Eve.
All right, so why is this such a busy week? Book launch? What's going on since last Thursday in the UK?
Well, yes, I've launched a new book, which is a religious response to religious extremism, and especially violence in the name of God. And I think the title says it all. It's called Not in God's Name. It's a religious protest against what's happening in so many parts of the world.
So how does Judaism deal with that, with, like, you know, fighting in God's name? I mean, our Bible is we call it milchemet mitzvah, like where you have to go out and fight. So how does Judaism deal with what we do in God's name? We talk all the time about, you know, sometimes, let's say, the Jews of the Holocaust died, you know, for in God's name. How does it work in Judaism, and how do you see that as different from perhaps how other religions interpret what must be done in the name of God?
The most extraordinary thing about Judaism is the extent to which what we call Torah Shebaal Peh, the ongoing commentary on the Torah, has been so active, in particular in thinking about religion, war, and peace. There's no question, if you read the Torah, the ultimate value in the Torah is peace. V'natati shalom ba'aretz. Moses tells the Israelites that if they stay true to the covenant, then a sword will not pass through your land. Obviously, initially, the wars of conquest in the days of Joshua, and all the way through to Israel's first kings. In fact, it was a perennial problem for Jews to live at peace with their neighbors. But, you know, historically, the first people in all of history to see peace as an ideal were Isaiah and then his younger contemporary Micah, who delivered those words that, of course, are engraved in stone opposite the United Nations building in New York. That vision of an age in which nation will not lift up sword against nation, neither will they learn war anymore. Clearly, it was the sequence of rebellions against Rome in the first and early second century, the Great Rebellion, and then the Bar Kokhba Rebellion, that had such tragic effects on Judaism, the destruction of the Second Temple, the leveling of Jerusalem to the ground, all sorts of horrendous consequences. So Judaism then became a much more pacific faith. And already then, by the first and second centuries, you have a limit by the rabbis of the concept of milchemet mitzvah, an obligatory war, limited to self-defense. And as Maimonides codifies the laws of war, no war is ever permitted without first the opportunities for peace having been explored and finally proved futile. So I think Judaism established that ground road to peace. Earlier, believe it or not, than Christianity. I mean, Jesus told his disciples, "I come to bring the sword, not a message of peace." So in truth, Judaism and Christianity had to fight their way through to the realization that war generally solves almost nothing, and therefore our major efforts must be made in the direction of peace.
So what has happened in today's world that really inspired is probably not the right word, but caused you to feel that you needed to write this, not in God's name? Is it the interpretation of Islam and what needs to be done in the name of Allah?
I think what happened is that the 21st century was basically defined by 9/11. Now, 14 years have passed since then, and we seem to be no nearer to confronting radical political Islam. America has, as it were, withdrawn after a feeling of the general failure of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq to circumscribe this movement. And we've seen a mutation from Al-Qaeda to even more brutal forms, like Boko Haram in Nigeria and ISIS in Syria and Iraq. So nothing the West has done thus far has begun to defeat or even contain this movement of violent and radical religiosity.
Could it be because the modern world, let's call it the Judeo-Christian world for lack of a better term right now, is loath to accept that this is a religious war? Jews, because as you said, we haven't fought one in 2,000 years, and Christians, because they did, and it didn't go very well, it ripped them apart in Europe for a long time, and therefore they've run from it to the completely other direction. And therefore there's this difficulty in accepting that there is now a religious war going on. It's not territorial, it's not anything else.
As they say in America, if it walks like a duck and it sounds like a duck, it probably is like a duck. If people are murdering the innocent, shouting God is great, then to even imagine that not religious does need, I think, a degree of denial that is not encouraging. What we are seeing is a religious war within Islam. The primary victims, incidentally, are Muslim. The secondary victims are Christians in the Middle East. I think the return of anti-Semitism to Europe is another symptom of it. But we are not actually, believe it or not, in the front line on this one. And this is a religious phenomenon. And the West, some parts of the West, certainly the political elites, have become so secularized that they find it very hard to reckon with the fact that they are confronting a religious phenomenon.
Now, do you have, you must have contact with other religious leaders to discuss this. What do they say to you, let's say Christian leaders, when it comes to this?
As chief rabbi for 22 years, obviously I had very strong and close relations with the leaders of all the other faiths in Britain. We have quite a few of them, Jews, Christians, Muslims, Hindus and Sikhs and Buddhists and Jain and Zoroastrian and Baha'i. And we work really closely with them. Somehow or other, you know, Jews who have been through persecution and really interreligious hostility for so long tend to be the people who pick this up first and fastest. Christians, I mean, there's so many Christians in the world. There are 2.4 billion Christians in the world, so it takes a long time for them to feel threatened. But I think they should feel threatened because Christians are really suffering. You know, the Christian population of Iraq at the time of the start of the Iraq war was 1.5 million. Today it's down to below 400,000 and falling fast. Mosul, which was one of the earliest Christian settlements in the whole world, now does not have a single Christian. In Afghanistan, the last church standing was burned to the ground in 2010. Christians have fled Syria. There are 5 million Coptic Christians living in fear in Egypt. Most of them want to leave if they could. The violence against Christians in Nigeria is becoming absolutely horrendous. You've seen 10-year-old girls captured and sold as slaves, other 10-year-old children captured and used as suicide bombers. I mean, these are crimes against humanity. They are the crime against humanity of our time. And obviously, I wish more Christians in the West would stand up and protest.
Why do you think that they don't?
I think Jews have a very, very strong principle called Kol Yisrael Arevim Ze Bezeh. We feel responsible for one another across the globe. As Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai said in the first century, when one Jew is injured, all Jews feel the pain. That's something that you don't find as deeply stressed in Christianity. So it's often the case where European and American Christians just don't see what's happening to Christians in the Middle East as something that directly concerns them. So I think that's probably it. Christians don't feel so much like a single, deeply interconnected family. But, you know, I do think we have to stand up for these persecuted Christian groups. Right now, of course, in Syria, it's the Druze who are a sect within Islam who are telling the world we are in real danger of genocide. So this is a very, very broad and wide and dangerous phenomenon.
And I think for our listeners that aren't aware of it, the only reason that Jews aren't being ethnically cleansed out of the Middle East, and that's really what's happening, as are the Christians, is because most of the Jews were already thrown out of the Arab world in the early 1950s. And most of them, of course, made their way to Israel. And Israel is the only country in the Middle East now where the Christian population is actually growing and thriving and not being persecuted as they are in the countries all around us. Now, Rabbi, you were just here in Israel. You just left, I think, like 5 minutes ago or something. I believe you just returned to Great Britain this morning. What were the impressions here? And you were very, very busy here while you were in Israel the last few weeks. What stands out from your trip here? What was your impression of what's happening here? I know you spoke at Herzliya. There's the BDS movement. You gave a lot of different lectures at a lot of different places. Maybe fill us in a little bit about the trip that you just had.
Steve, you know, this is something you know very well, but you travel around the world, as I do. You come to Israel and you realize there are few more exciting places in the world. So often things happen in Israel that just take your breath away. One of the reasons I came was to speak at the National Unity Day, organized in memory of the three teenagers who were killed tragically last summer. The parents of those three teenagers are some of the most extraordinary people I've ever met, because instead of simply grieving and feeling resentment, they used their moment to reach out to all Jews across all the divides in Israel and outside and said, let our son's death be the start of a real campaign for unity throughout the Jewish world. So I took part in that day, both in the conference and at the ceremony later in President Rivlin's house. And I was just so moving. You do realize, you begin to realize how strongly everyone in Israel connects with everyone else. Deep down, you know, we read the stories about the divides, but somehow I think every Israeli identified with the parents of those young boys. And they just lifted our spirits. And then you move from something like that to another thing that I did, which was actually to receive an award together with President Shimon Peres at the Rambam Hospital in Haifa. And there, the Rambam Hospital, because it was in direct line of the missiles from Hezbollah in 2006, that hospital has built now the world's largest underground hospital, currently used as a car park, but available to be mobilized at very few hours' notice to transfer the whole of the hospital from above ground to below ground. And you just see how Israel is bent in, with every fiber of its being, in sanctifying life. And some of the developments in medical technology, and some of the doctors at Rambam have themselves won Nobel Prizes, is all about enhancing life for the patients of the hospital, who can be Jews, Christians, Muslim, Druze, or indeed people from all over the world. So you come away from Israel feeling inspired that somehow this little brave and courageous country continues to push forward the parameters of holding life sacred in an area in the world where life is generally held so cheap.
So that's the impression, of course, that you got. That's the reality that I live every single day, which is why I couldn't live anywhere else. So why is it that the impression of Israel that, let's say, most of the world has is precisely the opposite? A place that targets children, a place where human rights are trampled on willy-nilly, a country that's actually turned, if I may say, into a pariah state, where people even question the viability of Israel, or if we have the right, the moral right to exist. And this is, of course, when there are many other countries in the world where that discussion doesn't happen, countries that are obviously just trample on everybody. And here we have the Israel that we know, and the Israel that other people think of. Why the 180-degree difference in particular about this little country?
Well, you know, that's something I explain in the new book. It's a terrible phenomenon which has to be fought against with all conceivable strength. The fact is, and we're going deep into psychology and anthropology here, but the greatest theorist on religion and violence, a French scholar called René Girard, argues that societies that are undergoing internal conflict need a scapegoat. They need a way of projecting their own conflicts onto some third party whom they can attack without real fear of reprisal. And historically, Jews have played that role. They were the scapegoat for conflicts within Christianity, for instance. And so you have the horrendous history of Christian anti-Semitism, which became very violent during the First Crusade in 1096 with the massacres of Jewish communities in Northern Europe. Now, Jews had almost no significance for Christians except that they could be demonized and made the scapegoat. The real thing challenging Christianity was Islam. It wasn't Jews. And that's what happened. Today there are immense conflicts within the Arab and Islamic world. And for the same reason, people have been projecting those conflicts outward onto the classic historic scapegoat, namely Jews. And of course, if you look at countries that never had any significant Christian or Muslim populations, you look at India, for instance, over a billion population, China, over a billion population. India and China, two civilizations, almost pretty much as old as Judaism itself. And they have never had any serious anti-Semitism in the whole of their histories. So anti-Semitism is a problem wherever you find Christians, wherever you find Muslims, and it flares up at times of internal conflict within those cultures. The really, really tragic thing is that this new anti-Semitism is beginning to sweep many of the international organizations in the world. I call it the new anti-Semitism because in the Middle Ages, Jews were hated for their religion. In Europe in the 19th and 20th centuries, they were hated because of their race. Today, they are hated because of their nation state. So the new anti-Zionism is the form that the new anti-Semitism takes. And it is as dangerous as any of the old forms and has to be fought. And it is tragic that so few real leaders of opinion in the West have stood up to fight it.
It seems like the far left and the far right politically have met at the point of commonality for them, for coming from completely different places, is Israel and the Jewish people, that Israel is now the excuse for anti-Semitism. And it's politically correct to be so. We're not anti-Semites. We don't like Israel's policies. And that's why you have it.
That's the historic danger of anti-Semitism. You will not get Western intellectuals or Western street demonstrators coming out and demonstrating in favor of ISIS, in favor of beheading and butchering and burning with fire, you know, innocent hostages. You will not get Western intellectuals coming out to demonstrate in favor of a theocratic state with no freedom of speech and no human rights. But if somehow you can turn that into a criticism of Jews or of Israel, you will get people to come together who would not come together under any other banner.
Exactly.
And that is what is dangerous about anti-Semitism.
Now, it seems to have taken a direction when it comes to this boycott, divest, and sanction movement. I know you have an article in today's Jerusalem Post about that. Perhaps tell our listeners a little bit about what you see as the danger in this movement. Is it economic? Is it to not support the settlements? Or is it really a cover for something much bigger?
I think there are a lot of people in the BDS movement who are innocent and accept that this is just about economics. But I think no one who's looked into it carefully can fail to realize this is the old assault on Israel or on Jews, just wearing new clothes. The BDS movement, I have to say, has not been a success. I mean, let us not exaggerate it. It is not backed by the British government. Even though it won a vote amongst a small group of British students, it is not backed by the heads of any British university. So the apparent successes are blown out of all proportion by the press. And I don't think we should be defeatist about this in any shape or form. We can fight this and we can win it. And we can win it without even talking about anti-Semitism, just talking about academic freedom. The BDS movement is an attempt to close down freedom of speech on universities. And that, of course, is a direct threat against the very concept of a university, which should be a place where we listen to opinions opposed to our own with serious respect. So I think the BDS movement is going to fail. It's just succeeded in capturing some headlines, but I think we can fight this one and we can win.
It's been said before, but it bears repeating over and over again, that to look at the Jews is to really see the canary in the coal mine, to see who it is that's trying to shut up or shut down the Jews, because that's who's going to come after you next. If they succeed in hurting the Jews in any way, physically or not, and no one says anything, then they come to other people. And we saw that with Nazism and with fascism, with communism and all the isms that have approached us over the years. But Rabbi Sacks, do you see a difference between what's happening in Europe and what's happening in other parts of the world?
I think Europe is, at the moment, the biggest danger zone. But the point that you make is absolutely correct, and it's what we've done in Britain since it began. And that is to say loud and clear and publicly in the public broadcasting media and press, that the hate that begins with Jews never ends with Jews. It wasn't Jews alone who suffered under Hitler. It wasn't Jews alone who suffered under Stalin. And it will not be Jews alone who suffer under radical political Islam. And I think, I have to say this, that the political leadership in Britain has always understood this. It has always stood firm against anti-Semitism. It has always stood firm against the attempt to do the BDS movement. The government itself has increased links between British universities and Israeli universities. So the government has made sure that every attempt to isolate Israel is met by a more powerful attempt to bring Israel back into the universal family of education and technology. So I think it's going to lose. But one thing has been very clear, and I've said it increasingly in the last few months. If Europe, if it is not safe to be a Jew in Europe, then it will not be safe to be a European in Europe. This may, on the surface, be about Jews and about Israel, but it's actually about Western democratic freedoms. And once you say that, then you begin to build up friends and allies, and we're no longer fighting from the position of a minority.
To get away from perhaps the political and Israel, there are very few holidays that I go into without your words in front of me, alongside of the words of the great rabbis through the ages. You write many commentaries, have put out the different machzorim, the different prayer books for the High Holy Days, the Haggadah for Pesach. And many people, including yours truly, consider you one of really the greatest philosophers, not just Jewish philosophers, but one of the greatest philosophers in modern times. Perhaps share with us a little bit about how that thinking process happens, how you put together, you know, you can look at some of the prayers, like, can anything new be found about a prayer that we've been saying for 2,000 years, for example? But yet you some seem to find the relevance for modern times to connect ideas that other people have not connected. If we can take a little peek into your mind, can you share with us how that process goes? Excuse me if this is very chutzpahdik kind of a question, but I'm just fascinated by how you think.
Yeah, let me explain how it happened.
Please.
I actually did not begin life wanting to be a rabbi. In fact, when Elena and I got married, it was still not on the horizon at all. I studied philosophy first at Cambridge, then at Oxford, and it was an incredible privilege because I was taught by some of the greatest philosophers in the world, most of whom, incidentally, were atheists. But I tended to feel, you know, the more I studied, the more I felt that philosophy wasn't the way that we found meaning or identity in life. Philosophy is very reasonable and rational, but it's not very full of content. And that's when I began exploring my Jewish heritage much more, very much encouraged by two meetings I had when I was actually quite a young student. Just begun at university, I had the privilege of meeting Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, the greatest Jewish thinker of the 20th century, and Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the greatest Jewish leader in many ways of the 20th century. And they really encouraged me to get involved, so I did. Now, a couple of years ago, I wrote a book about religion and science, and I compared them, you know, just as a metaphor, really, to the left and right hemispheres of the brain. The left hemisphere is very analytical. The right hemisphere is very integrative. And I said, that's really the difference between religion and science. Religion takes things, science takes things apart to see how they work. Religion puts things together to see what they mean. So, and those are respectively left and right brain type activities. So all I'm really doing is saying, look, here is the Siddur, here is the Machzeh, here is Parashat HaShavuah. What would it be like to encounter that through the left brain of contemporary secular culture, from neuroscience to cosmology to astrophysics to sociology, economics, and so on? So I think really all I'm doing is bringing together Torah together with general wisdom, much as many Jewish thinkers did in the past. It just doesn't seem to happen so often nowadays, so there are not that many people doing what I'm doing. But I hope that when you do it, it does make people say, you know what, this speaks to me, because it speaks to where I am here and now. So that's really how I think these things through.
And science, of course, of today is different than science 200 years ago. To some degree, we know more. But my feeling is the more we know, the more we realize that we don't know. And perhaps that's where religion fits in as well.
That's exactly so. I think that what's happening in science today is about to bring forth a huge revolution in our understanding of science as a whole. I'm thinking of the following. Number one, the discovery in recent years of what is called the plasticity of the brain. The brain isn't something fixed from birth. It's something that we actually change by the way we act. This is an absolute revolution. A second revolution is what is called epigenetics. People used to think that we're completely determined by our genes, but it turns out that what is happening to us at any given moment affects the expression of those genes. So this whole burgeoning new field of epigenetics, which is, again, telling us how much we can change ourselves if we're actually determined to do so. And I think, yet again, there's the issue of cosmology. You know, people used to think that science can explain the whole universe as one great simple machine. But it turns out, as even atheist scientists have to admit, that the universe is so finely tuned for the emergence of life that it simply couldn't have happened by accident. So I think science is getting more and more spiritual, if I can put it that way. And it may well be that science and religion are going to become much closer as friends rather than distant enemies.
Well, to get back to the topic of your new just-released book, Not in God's Name, I would imagine that there will be those who will say, you see, it's religion that's the cause of all wars, right?
Yeah,
so,
sure.
And those will be the scientists. How would you respond to that?
Well, somebody put together, a couple of scholars put together a classic text called the Encyclopedia of Wars, which analyzes 1,800 of the major conflicts since human history began. By their estimate, and they're not religious people, only 10% of all wars in the whole of history have had a religious cause. So religion is not the cause of most wars. The fact is, though, that it is alive and well today in parts of the world. Today we are facing religiously motivated warfare. So I don't think the scientific view that religion is the cause of all violence, or the defensive religious view that religion is never the cause of violence, I don't think either of them stands up to critical scrutiny. Religion sometimes is, often isn't.
So with the question that I had, the next question that I had for you in the few minutes that we have remaining, with all your vast knowledge and writing about Judaism, the Jewish holidays and the cycles, do you have a favorite? Do you have a favorite holiday? Do you have a favorite prayer, something that speaks to you more than anything else? That's not fair. It's like asking you have a favorite child, maybe.
Do I have a favorite prayer? Let me tell you this. I love the prayers, you know, and I tell you, I just love the fact that the rabbis were so enormously open-minded. So, for instance, they included within the Bible really subversive books, like the Book of Job or the Book of Kohelet. You know, any straight-laced religious authorities would not have included them at all. And then you have this passionate text of Shir HaShirim, you know, which is just a series of, it's a love duet, you know, some of the most beautiful love poetry in all of history. I just think the rabbis of those early generations, they were facing the most horrendous catastrophe. You know, Israel had been defeated by the Romans, Jerusalem was closed to Jews, temple was destroyed, and they came out with this wonderful burst of creativity. And then I think my other favorite period has to be the 16th century. You know, you had the trauma of the Spanish expulsion in 1492 and the Portuguese one in 1497, Spain and Portugal had been the arena of what Jews called their golden age. And suddenly it all turned against them, and eventually they were driven out. And many of them gathered together in Safat around this remarkable Jewish mystic called Rav Yitzchak Luria, the Arizal. And you would have thought they would have been absolutely traumatized. But out of that little world came two of the most beautiful bits of prayer, absolutely romantic love poetry of the kind that we last had in Shir HaShirim, namely Shlomo Alkabetz, Achad Odid Likrot Kala, come friend and let us meet the bride, and Eliyahu HaZikri's extraordinary love poem, Yedid Nefesh. I don't think people have ever spoken to God in more loving terms. And these were people who had been traumatized by tragedy. So it's this ability of Jews to use prayer to move them beyond tragedy into love and peace and hope. That is the unique resilience of the Jewish spirit, which I think has brought blessings to us, but now in the 21st century, should be shared with the world so that it can bring blessings to the world and to humanity as a whole.
And then we can be the light into the nations that we were asked to be a long time ago.
We have no choice, Eve. I think Isaiah set us that challenge. He inspired us by that challenge. And I think that is what, in a decent and just world, Israel, the state, and the people would actually be.
And we're here, and I think the world needs us more than ever. Thank you so much, Rabbi Lord Rabbi Jonathan Sacks.
Eve, thank you.
For a wonderful interview, and I know this won't be your last book. I know we're going to keep hearing from you for a long, long time. Thank you so much, everybody. Still more to come, Rejuvenation on Voice of Israel, and thank you to Ben Bresky and to Elizabeth as well for making this all happen.
You have been listening to an Eve Harrow interview recorded on June 14th, 2015.
Shalom, everybody. This is Jeremy Gimpel from the Land of Israel Network, but also from the Land of Israel Fellowship. We have members from 31 countries joining us every week, Sunday, live at 6 p.m. For those that can't make it live, they get a direct recording. Just go to thelandofisrael.com/fellowship. We're growing together, we're learning together, we're celebrating together. The gates are open for all who want to come and join.